Shalom, everybody, and welcome to the Yishai Fleischer Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world. You're a part of it wherever you are. We're back from Brooklyn, and we're back in Yerushalayim, Yir HaKodesh. I am so thankful to God that I get a chance to shuttle between the diaspora, and really, not only the diaspora, but like Brooklyn, which is, I think, one of the hearts of the diaspora, of today's, today's like heart of the main diaspora thing. It's a main impetus, its main impulse, okay? And to come back to Yerushalayim, Yir HaKodesh, I get to see the tension between these things so much more kind of clearly, because I kind of look at them like comparing book notes, comparing things one to one. That's a lot of fun. And now, thank God, back in Yerushalayim. And how could I be back in Yerushalayim without saying shalom to Rabbi Mike Foyer? Rabbi Mike, shalom.
Oh, shalom, Yishai. How are you doing?
Rabbi Mike, it's so great to be with you back here.
Welcome
again.
Welcome home.
Thank you very much. Strangely, I'm also at home in Brooklyn, right?
We have spoken about it many times.
And what's so funny about it all is that you kind of get to really compare the modes. It's a different modality that Jews are in. And I started realizing something that I think a lot of your students here, and I want to mention the Pardes Institute, great institute, which is so edgy and interesting. Love to be here. Love to see you in action here. And also, by the way, I do want to thank the Land of Israel Network. And I want to do a shout out to our good buddy Ari, who recently got married and is on a honeymoon in an undisclosed location.
Oh,
I can't
God
say where,
him.
But I can only say that I hope that you're having a great time, Ari, and we miss you. We love you. Have a great time out there. See you soon.
And that you're not spending your time on your honeymoon listening to us.
Right. I'm sure he will, though. Come
he
on.
Does. I know
he's
he does.
He's a religious listener. Both
Tarte Mashma.
Tarte Mashma, exactly. I just want to say one thing before we jump right into the Torah portion, which is so thick, so many things, because I think this Torah portion, the first parsha of the book of Exodus, the book of Shemot, is itself a type of Bereshit. Mm-hmm. It is a Genesis.
It is a new beginning, for sure.
It's a new beginning. It's like a new chapter. Did you see the words in the stars, talking about like in Star Wars, you know, the like...
Oh, as it floats backwards.
Right, like,
you know, in the
new beginning.
A new beginning,
right,
I gotcha.
Right, a new hope. I just wanted to say one thing, and I'm sure this could be a much longer conversation. One of the things that I've come to realize, a new realization that I've had, is that when American Jewry critiques Israeli Jewry, it has a kind of embedded and what's it called, like built-in problem, and mm-hmm. that is American Jewry or exile Jewry is in a different modality than Israel Jewry.
Why? Sure.
One has the classic shtadlanut, core Jewry. Folks, I am not saying this in a pejorative, judgmental fashion. I mean to say, literally, this is a system of operation the Jews have. We hear about it in the Joseph story. We hear about it in the Mordechai story. We hear about it in the Daniel story. We hear about it all the time. But that mode has a very hard time understanding the mode of being a sovereign. And an addendum to that, a natural philosophical mode, a modality for exilic Jewry is liberalism, because what you're really telling truth to power to the sovereign is be liberal.
Right, because otherwise you won't tolerate us as a minority in your midst.
Right.
Yes.
So it's the right thing to send out as a signal, as a philosophical signal.
It's a survival mechanism.
Right.
Yeah.
But being the sovereign means almost by definition, it means that you have to be illiberal to the forces that are trying to topple you.
Right. I mean, there's a difference between liberalism and tolerance. Meaning, as a sovereign, you might have it in your interest to be tolerant, but sovereignty and liberalism is a tough relationship.
Right.
Right. Because sovereignty tends to define itself by monopoly, whether it's a monopoly on the use of force, whether it's a cultural monopoly, what have you. It's why the civil nation state is on the ropes right now throughout the world. You know, in the sort of the halcyon decades following World War II, where it looked like the economy was just going just fine and that the forces of evil had been kept at bay. So the civil nation state made some strides. But now the ethnic nation state is making a very strong comeback because of that sense that stability in a sovereign state actually has to do with a monopoly of power.
Mm-hmm, absolutely true. And it's also, it's very, very tough to get everybody, like 300 million people, around the same idea.
True.
That's very tricky business. That's really tricky business.
Sure.
Especially if you don't inculcate it by force or more forcibly.
Well, even worse, at the root of American culture, whether people know it or not, is rugged individualism. Meaning the very core of American culture is like, you know, don't tread on me, step off my lawn, like, don't tell me what to do.
Right.
They're very Jewish in that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not very Jewish?
They are very Jewish in that way. That sort of stiff-necked sense that you know better.
Right, and yet though Israel has got the Jewish people in an Israeli mode have a corporate culture as well, which we become corporatized as opposed to being rugged individualists.
There's for sure. There's tension between the particular and the individual, and Am Yisrael runs deep.
Right. And somewhere in there is also the relationship between the exile and Israel Jewry. And like, for example, when you're coming out of the Exodus and you're coming into the land of Israel, so there really isn't so much, although it does get formed, there isn't so much of an exilic Jew looking back at you and critiquing you, right?
No. Right? The whole package enters. I mean, that's in many ways why the people who came out of Egypt simply could not go into the land. We could look at the narrative in many ways and like, oh, they blew it here, they blew it there. But bottom line, as the Rambam says, you can't go from slavery to freedom that quickly.
Right.
There has to be a transformation. Right.
Because you become institutionalized.
Yes, that's right.
That's right. But now we're in this point where there's these two poles, and these two poles kind of critique one another. The Israeli pole critiques the diaspora pole, says, you're outmoded, you're outdated, you're not the future, you're assimilating, you don't have a Judaism to really teach me either anymore, right?
And you don't appreciate the threats that we function under, and you're actually undermining our sovereignty and security.
Right. But says the diaspora Jew, you are too rough, you are insensitive to minorities, you have a lot of...
you've lost your moral compass.
And you're also corrupt.
Yeah.
For example, you have corruptions. You have this. You have that.
Right.
Okay. And you squelch the individual. You squash him.
And note. And
you squash my religion.
You threaten our security in the lands in which we live through your behavior, with which we are identified.
Right. Right.
You know. Like the blaming Israel for the rise of anti-Semitism. But that's
silly to me. That one's not a real argument.
You know, I don't know.
You're right that people say that, but
whatever, you get into the logic of it, but you can understand.
Because Jews without Israel are much more threatened in the end of the day.
There's no question about that. But my point is that in the immediate, it is true that, you know, when we go toe-to-toe with Palestinians at the border fence in Gaza, that there is potentially immediate fallout for Jews who live in France.
Say. Yes, yes, absolutely. Okay, very good. So these are the tensions, but that also leads to one thing, which is I say to them, it's not that you don't have a right to judge. I never say that. I think you do have a right to judge.
Of course, yeah.
I can't say, no, because, you know, there's always like, I don't have a right to say what to do in Israel.
Right, yeah.
I'm like,
not
you have
that.
The right as much as you want. It's just, I also have the right to take you less or more seriously, right? But it is true, I say to them sometimes, I'm not sure that you have the ability to judge a different modality of existence altogether.
So that's what I want to add, Zeres. The task for those of us who care about both poles is to craft a language where we're actually speaking to each other.
Right.
Instead of, like you're pointing out, you know, using words that mean fundamentally different things from two very different frameworks.
Right. I think one of the things that folks, liberal folks here in this institution, need to hear from time to time is that, and I have crafted this kind of language for myself, which is that I don't, As a Zionist, I don't at the same time totally poo-poo the diaspora as a, you know, bereft, empty, backwards, punishment.
Historical anachronism.
Right. I don't think so. I think, okay, you have your place, you have your role, you've had your survival systems, and I honor and respect that. However, we're in a very exciting time. Join us or don't join us, but be part of the story.
Look, and there's a deep challenge there in Zionism, which maybe we'll speak about another time, because one of the core philosophical principles of all the early Zionists was Shlilat HaGalut, was the negation of exile culturally, physically, politically, and that has not gone away. Right. You know,
what I'm saying.
It's a hard posture to change within Zionist thought.
Right, and when I was on a plane just now, and I was talking to French people, and they were telling me what's going on in France, and they were not sparing the rod about what's going on in France. Like, uh-huh. You hear stuff on the news, a lot of times I take it with a grain of salt.
Right.
I don't know how bad it is because I know what they say about other places.
Right, you know what it looks like in the news here. Right,
right. And I know that it's skewed. I spoke to French people from regular neighborhoods in Paris, and they're like, dude, it's very bad. It's very, very bad. And the stewardess who was from France doesn't want to ever go back there again. The family, a wealthy, smart family right next to me left the place. He's got one son-in-law as a Chabadnik in a very bad neighborhood. and he wants him to leave. The thing is, like, let's put it this way. It's not. It's like going the way of South Africa, where Jews exist,
but in walled compounds.
Right, in walled compounds, and it's like not a good life, and they certainly don't want their kids to keep going in this right direction. So right, that's the, that.
That's
that,
such bad news.
That's wow. France. That's France.
Really sad.
On the one hand, it's sad. On the other hand, no, it is sad. Okay, I don't mean to be, but sometimes we take a colder philosophical or historical approach where we like it's sad. But on the other hand, if we indeed are involved in the project of building the Jewish state, and if these people are coming, and that Paris project, that the French project, is over, then it's sad. But it's also, in a sense, the thing happened to my parents, which is, can I be sad that my parents left the Soviet Union? I'm not sad about that.
Right.
I'm happy about that.
I hear that.
Okay, I'm happy about that. And when it comes to America, I surely do not want it to turn into a big anti-Semitic country. I do, and I don't want to do Shlilata Galut, as you were saying, but we are involved in this giant project. Are you going to be part of it? And are you going to, you know, as many people as possible to come home and be part of it?
You know, it deserves a revisiting, in my opinion, of Ahad Am's vision of the state of Israel as a spiritual center. Now that we've actually achieved the political aims, which he actually disagreed with and was completely wrong about, by the by, in saying that millions of Jews would never make it here.
Right.
But nevertheless, now that we've proven him wrong on that front, I think it's worth revisiting proving him right, that we can become a thriving spiritual cultural center, which is broadcasting to people who either don't want to or won't make it here, but nevertheless see this as truly the center of our culture.
It's so funny you say that, because somewhere, either in the shower or halfway to sleep somewhere, I had a thought about Ahad Am, and I wanted to say to him, see, you were wrong both times. I was thinking to myself, we're like, yes, the Jews will be strong here, but also it's not liberalism which is the right modality here right now.
Right.
It's more strength.
And yeah, I mean, what that spiritual vision is not an issue to me right now.
Right.
But like really putting the same amount of effort that we put into this sort of physical security, putting it into our spiritual and cultural security is like a very important thing.
You keep talking about that over and over again. That's a theme, that's an important theme for you. And,
for
and
sure.
I think it's an important theme, which is basically spiritual and moral content within the confines of this
It's
bodily,
our mission in the world.
Right. I can only say that mission can really be accomplished in this mode with strength. I mean, say once the body is mature and strong.
Yeah, absolutely. No, absolutely.
Not in the diaspora necessarily. The
no,
diaspora,
I think actually one of the things that we have to offer to the world that is most important right now, we haven't quite worked it out, but we're getting there, is what does a healthy relationship with power look like?
Right.
Because the world is really sort of crumbling around that question right now. And people who have sort of like, I think, a really good heart are allowing evil to flourish because they've assumed that power by definition is evil.
Right.
And so therefore only the evil will wield power. And all these like good-hearted, really good-hearted people who have beautiful ideas are basically just laying down.
Parenthetically, I'm referring you to our off-air conversation about certain individuals and power.
Yeah, I know. I hear it.
All right. That was in parentheses.
All right, back to work.
I want to say, though, just to you one last thing before we go right into the parsha.
You got the last
word. What I love so much about this conversation that we're having right now, where we're having it, in this educational institution in Jerusalem, at Pardes specifically, is the edge. I just love the fact that we're right now discussing the issues, the formulating issues, the issues that are being born and that are hashed out, you know, and really the things that people are struggling with. And those are great places to be. You're in a great educational institution which really straddles that edge. I know that in Hebron also, I feel a lot of times what I love about it is that it's really the questions of our time are being hashed out.
Physically, morally, spiritually, politically, for sure.
Okay, so speaking of the tension between the diaspora and the land of Israel, or between a lot of things, between slavery and between freedom, comes this week's Torah portion, which I think, as I was saying before, is a type of Genesis Torah portion. It's really an immense setup with incredible tiny stories and characters of massive heroism and massive proportions. As we're going to learn about the birth of Moses, Moshe Rabbeinu, I want us to, have you ever read these Baal Shem Tov stories where there was the knife of Abraham was somehow appeared?
Sure.
Or,
that's a Karl Liner story,
right,
by the way.
It's a Shlomo Carlbach story, right, that he tells about the Karl Liner, right? Or anybody who has ever, like, there is a Baal Shem Tov story where he had the kavana that Abraham once had about Hamotzi,
mm-hmm.
and he started shaking. For 45 minutes, he couldn't stop shaking. When you touched him, you started shaking. What I mean to say is, can you imagine for a second what it is to meet Moses, to see Moses, to touch Moses in your life? And I mean that in the most real sense. You know, have you ever imagined what is it like? This is like an image I like to think about. What's it like when he's coming down off the mountain and his face is shining, and you're there in the crowd and you see that? What's that like?
It's very powerful what you're saying, because you know when the Gemara asks that somewhat mystifying question, Moshe mina Torah minayin. Where do we find proof for Moshe from the Torah? Which is just a mind-boggling question, which we're going to leave alone what the Havamina, as we say, is. Its answer is Vishagamhu Basar. It's a verse back from the story of Noach, when God decides that his spirit will only rest with man for 120 years because he's also made from flesh. And it's a deep message about Moshe, which is exactly what you're saying, is don't lose sight of the fact that he was a real person.
Right, right.
Like, don't lose sight of the fact that you could have met him, that when he came down off the mountain, your question of what does his face look like was something that other people had to actually answer in their experience.
Right.
And it's so important, because it's so easy to let these stories become either, God forbid, meaningless fantasies, or even like sort of like religious
mythology,
right. Which, and those are important, like they're important lessons to be taken from that direction, but it has to be grounded in the flesh.
Right. Absolutely.
Otherwise, it can't actually make a difference in the world, in my opinion.
That's right. It's real.
Yeah. It's
real.
Meant to be real.
And when I say real, I mean the word emet, truth. It's truthful.
Yes.
That's all right. We'll get back to the issue of truth. By the way, I've been I have to tell you that a secular not a secular. Take that back. Sorry, that was the wrong word. A not Jewish and I think it's correct to say Christian, not theologian, but psychiatrist, psychologist, whose name is Jordan Peterson, I've been listening to recently.
Oh, yeah, you're on the train.
I've been listening to a book, and his chapter on truth,
uh-huh.
on being truthful and truth, like, was like...
That's his revolutionary chapter, I've heard from a lot of people.
I was just like, whoa, that is... I was like... All it did was strengthen by a lot the consciousness that I had in my life about the word truth and the importance of truth. But that was a revolutionary chapter. It's worth listening to. So we'll talk about Emmet later on. Okay.
Okay.
The Jewish people are in the diaspora. Things are not so bad. Joseph is alive. His brothers are alive. But Joseph begins to die. He dies off. His brothers die off. And the Jewish people slowly become enslaved. The way that they become enslaved is piecemeal. Okay, they are first called to be good Egyptian citizens, and then after that, slowly but surely, they become, through a process, more and more enslaved.
Their rights are deprived.
First, they are paid workers, as all of us have to chip into the national project.
Indentured servitude.
Right. So suddenly, they're not paid at all. And they become, the Egyptians enslaved the children of Israel with glib talk, is one of the explanations of the word farech, which is a hard labor, but it's also with a soft mouth. Okay,
perach.
They invite them in. They say, no, be
soft
part
tongue.
Of our thing.
Yeah.
Soft tongue. And then with time, more and more do they become enslaved, as the old adage is, to boil a lobster, right? You don't throw the lobster into boiling water. You put him into nice warm water in the bath, and
you
then
start
to
crank it up.
You crank it up slowly but surely, and before he knows it, he's dinner.
Not for us.
Not for us, of course.
Somebody else, perhaps.
Okay, their lives become embittered, and then there's this famous story about, and I told Malka, who my beloved wife Malka is also a birth coach, I told her, this is your Torah portion. This is the Torah portion of birth coaches. The king of Egypt tells here's tricky. Is it to the Hebrew, midwives, or is it the midwives of the Hebrews? And I heard a rabbi explain that in the simple level, all the sages say, of course, these are the great midwives of Israel. This is Yocheved and Miriam. But he said, listen, you have to understand this on a plain level, which is these are the midwives, the Egyptian midwives, who are part of the court. And he says to them, this is what I want you to do. And what he actually tells them to do is kill the baby boys before they're born. Okay? There was a way to recognize in the ancient world what the sex of the baby is, and basically kill them in utero. He basically wanted to create a quiet plan to off the baby boys and mm-hmm. to temper the generational explosion, the population explosion. These midwives, whether they are midwives or their midwives, didn't heed the word of Pharaoh, and instead they kind of saw God. They saw God, and they did not allow this thing to happen. So Pharaoh says to them, "How come you didn't fulfill my commandment?" They're like, "Listen, they are midwives to themselves. They know they're either they're like animals who give birth quickly, or they're midwives to themselves. And before we even get there, they give birth." So that secret plan to try to kill off the babies
came to naught.
And God blessed these midwives by giving them houses. Rashi says the houses of the Levites. And basically, like, this is maybe a preamble to the Moses story where you've allowed, you know, these children to live. Now I'm going to give you a special child. Pharaoh goes nuclear, and he says, "Kill them all. Kill all the boys," not in a hidden fashion, but in an overt fashion. Here, another interesting thing. The sages say that actually what he said was, "Kill all the boys, including the Egyptian boys."
Yes.
In one day.
All male children on this day.
Right, because the stars had shown that a redeemer would come from the water, and all. So he offs all the baby boys. He's genocidal. He wants to keep power at all costs. And then a man from the house of Levi takes a woman from the house of Levi, and she becomes pregnant. They have no names at this point. Why don't they have names? Here I heard that the idea was that this was to show Pharaoh that societally this is what people were doing. They were like, "Your decree is that we shouldn't get married and have children. You're trying to stop family life? No, we will have family life." Oh, this is Nechama Leibowitz, who said that you couldn't understand this pasuk until after the Holocaust, when you saw that even in the Holocaust, even in the DP camps, people were getting married and having children, even having faced the horror. And the child is born. He is unusually good. Either his name is good, or a light came into the room when he was born. To me, the word "vatereoto kitovhu," she saw that it was good, harkens right back to Genesis.
For sure. And another one of the understandings of the Midrash of what kitovhu is that he was born mahul, he was born circumcised, which I think is an important addition here, because unlike the first round of creation, where the world lacked a clear link between God and humanity. I mean, Avraham comes along eventually and sort of like receives the covenant, right? But here, the second round is beginning with it built in. Right, here's Moshe, says God, says this is all about a fulfillment of a covenant which already exists. So though it is a sort of a reworking of Genesis, and I would say a revelation of a deeper layer in creation, it's not the same as a world which actually was at risk of uncoupling from the intention of its maker.
It's a great point, and that's another way of saying what you just said, is when God will come to Moses in just a bit, he'll basically say to him, "I am the God of your forefathers, of Abraham and Jacob." The program...
He gives him the password.
Right, the program has been laid out. Just access the password, right, exactly.
Yeah.
Access the program, and it's Pekod Yifkod, right? That's the famous password.
That's right.
Login moses@god.gov. Okay.
Gov. That was the best part. This is not .com.
No. That's .gov for sure. God.gov. G.
Big G.
G at gov.
Big G.
Okay. .global. Okay. So they build a little ark for him. Little Moses and the little ark. Here in Israel, by the way, you know...
Love it.
Yeah, they have a food item. You know, in America, what do we call these things?
Pigs in a blanket.
Pig in a blanket.
But Israelis aren't going to eat a pig in anything.
We're not going to eat a pig in a blanket. Okay?
Nope.
First thing, I don't even want to eat a blanket.
Yeah.
And I don't want to eat a pig.
It's certainly not wrapped around a pig, yeah.
Right, but what I do want to eat is a Moshe Bateva.
That's
right. I want to eat a little Moses.
It's great, isn't it?
Moses in
when I told my kids that in America,
wait,
Moshe Bateva, it's an ark.
An ark, right. Moses in an ark.
That when I told my kids that in America they call Moshe Bateva pigs in a blanket, they said, "Ew, why would you eat something?" I said, "But you're eating Moses in the ark." Yeah. And they were like, "So what?"
Yeah, Moses in the ark. That's
of
good.
Of course, that's what they're called,
yummy,
Abba.
Yummy, yummy, okay?
It's a great cultural moment.
Okay, folks, so you understand what I'm saying? What in America is called pig in a blanket is here called Moses in an ark. And little Moses is ensconced in such a little arc, and he's set. He actually one of the mistakes that people make is he's not set on the river. That's not correct. He's just put in the reeds.
Yes.
The Prince of Egypt, you know, thing dramatizes him like
he's go through rapids and stuff.
Yeah, rapids and boats are crushing
him. Yeah, it's like a class 3 okay. adventure there.
But it's good. All right. But it's well done. But in any case, that's not what really happens. What really happens is a little bit simpler that Moses is kind of put into. He's not Moses yet. He's put into. So Moses is he's not yet Moses. He's put into this ark, and he's then picked up by the daughter of Pharaoh, and she opens up the ark. First thing, I love that the sages. There's a lot of midrash here about her spotting him. She like her hand like extends. It's a big thing. Even I saw in all the different explanations. They're like, yeah. See, this shows that her hand extended.
Like something Inspector happened. Inspector Gadget.
Right, like something like that. That's right. It's interesting. The word, right, there's a word, hishtarveva, like shravravut, which means like plumbing.
Right.
The extension of like the ability to extend. And she pulls him out of the water and she opens up the ark and she sees a crying bush child. I say this every year. I'm going to say it again this year. This is the most incredible, heartrending explanation of the Chief Rabbi of Tel Aviv, Rabbi Lau,
mm-hmm.
who said he understands what this verse means. He says, what does it mean? Why did she see a child crying? Didn't she hear him crying beforehand? She said when she opened it up, she saw that he was crying, but he was making no sounds. He says, in the Holocaust, that's exactly what we learned to do. We were children. We had to cry, but we learned how to cry silently because we had to hide. Oh, man. That brings it home. And that also reminds you, this was a Holocaust. There was a real enslavement here, okay? In any case, the child, the midrashically refuses to drink Egyptian milk at this point and doesn't ask, but...
For Chalav Yisrael.
He is a Chalav Yisrael. He holds by Chalav Yisrael and a Chalav Stam. Or Chalav Nochri. And he wants the Hebrew nursemaid, his sister... says, how about I bring it to one of the Hebrew nursemaids? And she says, okay. And the child is weaned, returned, grows, returned to daughter of Pharaoh, and she calls him Moshe, saying, from the water I pulled him out. They say that in Egyptian, Mashit, or I forgot exactly the Egyptian, the old Egyptian word for it, but it's something to do with, it's really son. Like S-O-N. Mm-hmm. So she called him son.
She adopted him.
She adopted him. And then later on, Hashem is going to say, meaning to say, this really means from the water I pulled him out. But she didn't say something in a Hebrew or Canaanite language. Egyptian is not a Semitic language. Any case, so then he, that's it. That's what we learn about Moses. And he's going to grow up in the palace. He's going to be the prince of Egypt.
And there's a critical element in this. Notice that the parallel that up until now we've had no names. And then suddenly the first name comes to the Redeemer from the Egyptian. And the Maharal, a great sage of Prague in the turn of the 17th century, says that that the Redeemer always has to come from outside. That there's some element, and I know it's not very popular in our modern sort of like positive psychology, do it for yourself type of world, but there's some element of redemption which has to come from without. And that Moshe has to be raised outside of the people in order to essentially liberate them, because you cannot, like, you know, the Gemara says that in asir matir tatzmo, right? The prisoner can't free himself,
right?
And I think that's a critical element of this whole story, not just between Moshe and Israel, but between God and the world. Meaning, there's a question. It's like, well, if God created Bereshit, if He created Genesis at the beginning, wasn't the world sufficient? Why did God have to stick God's nose back into history, as it were? Right? Why isn't the God of creation enough? Why do we need the God of Yitziat Mitzrayim, of Exodus? And I think the answer is because without that, then we make gods out of ourselves. Humanity is always dancing around the edge of worshiping itself. And there's two things that can teach us that we're not in control, disaster or redemption. And the great hopefulness of this story is that disaster is not an inevitability. You know, it's like today, like, you know, some people are worried about global warming, or people are worried about, global war or economic meltdown or what it is. And I feel like a part of that is a desire to feel like humanity is not in control, that there are things bigger than us. But how many people are really ready for redemption? There is another option. There is another option from all these negative fantasies that we have to keep our society in check. And that's really what's happening, right? Be careful. Be more conservative, small C, you know, like be more humble, lest we have global warming or economic meltdown. Well, the other answer is that, hey, you remember God? Like, there's actually a plan outside of just
here,
us.
Here, Jordan Peterson also talks about another concept, which is chaos versus order.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're talking about is this kind of fear of chaos.
Oh, yes.
There's a total fear of chaos. And there's also fear-mongering of chaos.
Well, that serves, yeah, for sure, it's because it serves very definite purposes.
One of the greatest Israeli Middle East analysts, his name is Guy Bechor.
Mm-hmm.
And he, if you ever hear him talk, in every single talk he gives, he rips into the media. He's like, the security analysts, their job is to sow insecurity. The Arab analysts are always there to tell you that we're on the edge of war because that's what they want to do. They want to create their job and their reality, and
mm-hmm.
and he rips their irresponsibility in sowing a sense of chaos all the time. And I wonder about that in general, about media. I think that, for example, I'll give you an example. I think that every media outlet should have a clear and bold section of good news.
Right.
Just, it should be part of...
I've noticed the New York Times has started doing that.
The New York Times, I was going to say, is actually a paper that always has had that.
Yeah.
Interesting.
They actually started labeling it like good news.
Good news, yeah.
You know?
You should. It's weird that the New York Times would be that paper, but I remember, you know, being a New Yorker, reading it in the suburbs, there's oftentimes articles about interesting and good
public
things.
Public interest, personal right. interest, just like...
Not
yeah.
darkness.
No,
just,
no.
So credit where credit is due. And you could learn a lot from the New York Times and how they do things.
I think it's critical what you're pointing out because it's a self-generating reality, and there's a lot of darkness in the human being that just doesn't need press. Just doesn't need press,
right? Right?
Because it grows, it gains legitimacy, it gains power over people's minds.
And good things need press.
Yeah.
The world is good. God is good. Life is good.
We are Elim Kitov.
Right. Life is not chaos. It's God is munificent, and he gives a good life.
I like a little bit of chaos.
Yeah, no, there's plenty of chaos. But any case, speaking of chaos, comes Moses out of the castle, out of the palace, and he is there now looking. This reminds us of kind of Dina, who comes out to see what's going on, but he really wants to see his brothers. Vayetza el Echav, he goes out to see his brothers. So we understand now that somehow there's a transition, that somehow Moses knows that the Israelites are his brothers.
Right.
That's an interesting thing.
Yeah, and it's a deep question, and the Midrash has all kinds of answers. But in the end of the day, I think what it's really meant to teach us is the depth of his character.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the easiest thing in the world is to leave your people behind.
Right. Especially for him.
Yeah.
Just turn away. Oh, by the way, speaking of people from the outside, just two more to name. One is Rabbi Akiva.
Yeah.
Okay, here's a guy that is not within the mainstream, comes from the outside, learns from the outside. Another one is, of course, Theodore Herzl. Okay,
mm-hmm.
here's a savior
yep.
who comes deeply from the outside. I chafe so badly at those people who say to me, those ignorant people who say to me, they're not ignorant people, but they have ignorant opinions on this matter, who say to me, oh, he, you know, Herzl wanted to convert wanted all of the Jews to convert to Christianity. Oh, Herzl wanted everybody to move to Uganda. I'm like, that is the mark of a thinking man who is trying to save his people.
Hey, he was trying to solve the problem.
Right, trying to solve the problem. That is, to me, it's a mark of great pride, a great honor that this man is thinking and working it, okay?
Yeah.
And your little way to like poo-poo a man who died in order to realize the dream of Zion, like I hate petty, you know, petty critiques that have no sense of depth of who this person was, what was like. Anyway, it bothers me to know.
No, it's the way people can save themselves from being challenged by great ideas,
exactly.
Great thinkers.
Well put. In any case, Moses comes out and he knows that it's his brothers, and he sees an Egyptian hitting a Hebrew of his brothers.
Don 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 don.
Great pasuk here. Vayifen kovacho. He turns this way and that way.
Before he crossed the street.
That's right. Vayar kienish. And he saw that there was no man. Simply, the simple meaning is?
Nobody's looking.
Nobody's looking. The deeper meaning is, he looked around for a person to do action. He saw there was nobody but himself. B'makom she'en anashim, tishtadel yod ish. A place where there's no people, try to be a person.
And even more so, says Rashi in the words of the Midrash, he saw that this person had no potential convert in all the generations that were coming out from him. Mm-hmm. Meaning that the ein ish, there's no continuity. There's no humanity in this Egyptian taskmaster.
That is so good. That is so good. Also,
just Rashi.
Also, v'yifen ko v'cho means like he. To me, it also means he contemplated this way and that way.
Right.
I
could deal with this in many ways. Think about it.
Right.
I could walk away.
I could walk away.
I could try to intervene and be nice guy and problem solve.
Right.
You know, but he said, realized, no, the power balance is so imbalanced here between the slave and master. There's only one thing to do.
Right. V'yifen ko v'cho, like I consider, and that's very Jewish. I considered it. I run it this way. I run it that way. Like how I gamed it out. How do I play it? What's the right thing to do? What's the moral thing to do?
Right.
And that's, by the way, one of the great problems. A Jewish person has to have a, I'm dating myself, like a Cray computer, like a supercomputer on his head. Because when we consider moral questions, we really have to go through tomes of moral, and religious and law and all these things that we have in our collective heads. Sometimes I think that one of the things that the secular Zionists basically did was say, listen, we do have a ton of info, but we also have to act.
This is what I was thinking.
And we've got to break through all that because you cannot process all these things all the time.
So you got to tune in for the final episode of season 2 of The Jewish Story coming up, because it's tentatively titled The Three Decisions That Still Shape Our State Today. And Ben-Gurion did just that. He made these decisions almost without thought, and they shape our state to this day.
Yeah, yeah.
And if he hadn't done them, in my eyes, the state perhaps would not come into being.
It's amazing how certain decisions, for example, those great decisions of Ben-Gurion, but also the decisions of returning the Temple Mount, the Moshe Dayan decisions,
sure.
We face those very much. Or the Oslo decisions, which I feel, this is now in parentheses, I want to say to you, like I oftentimes think that one of the missions of this generation is to undo Sinai and Oslo. Okay, but let's just stick to Oslo for now. But
you know you're going to get a fight out of me on the Sinai.
Yeah, because I want to agree to agree here that
whole paradigm.
That whole paradigm to really reverse that, not just intellectual paradigm, but also
on the ground facts.
Right, the deep state that has been formed from it.
Yeah, for sure.
So like that's hard. Those decisions are hard. Anyway, Vayifen Kovacho. Love that. Love those words. Kovacho, Kovacho. I also like it because it's a palindrome. I like. Well, it's not exactly a palindrome, but it's like it's a balanced.
It's Kovacho. Nice. It's neat.
It's balanced. That's what it is. Anyway, he saw that there's in a person. He strikes the Egyptian down. Oh, another midrash is that he didn't strike him, but he said God's name.
Yeah.
And that zapped him.
Well, you know, it's beyond zapping. I want you to picture that when Moshe says God's name,
right,
all of reality snaps into focus.
Right.
And what happened is this guy just wasn't part of the picture.
Right.
It's like all reality snaps into focus. It's total consciousness in that moment, and this guy is just he's just not.
I don't know why, but that just really makes me laugh. By the way, I want to tell you something that happened last week. Last week, I did a show.
You pronounced the divine name?
No, it was like 1 o'clock in the morning in Brooklyn. I had been working for days without a lot of sleep. I had been drinking a beer, and I did a show last week.
Always a bad choice.
No, our beloved listeners, our good friends, I think that they have fun with those shows. And I asked folks to send me Jewish jokes.
Uh-huh.
And I got quite a bit of Jewish jokes. I have to say they were oftentimes kind of corny. Okay,
what a surprise!
I'm looking for a little bit more, a little bit more English on the ball, friends. I love you guys all so much, but like a recurring joke that I got three times from three different people was the one about the priest blames the Jew for killing Uncle Jay, and then he says, no, the Muslims did it. And then the Muslims said, we weren't even around to then. He goes, okay, now let's talk about Jerusalem.
Right, yeah.
I got that like three or four times, whatever. Okay. I need a little bit more. I need a little bit more wit. Okay, guys, I'm looking for. So please do me a favor. I'm asking for more Jewish jokes. Don't let my words just now scare you. Send me any of your Jewish jokes. Hashtag Jewish jokes. They make me laugh. And please don't be too politically correct. Meaning to say, if it's making fun of Jews and stuff like that, that's okay. I can live with that. All right. Okay. In any case. Okay. So next day. Oh, so that was pretty heroic. You're awesome. You just killed a bad guy. bang.
With the name of God.
Right. You are holy. You are awesome. You are Moses. You are the Redeemer. Next day.
You don't know who the Jews are. Right.
Next day, he sees two Jews fighting one another. He says, "Vayetze b'yom hasheni," came out the second day. "V'nei shnei anashim ivrim," there's two Hebrews, "nitzim," they're fighting one another. "Vayomer l'rasha," he says to the Russia. Here he goes into the different mode, like you said, like that mode of, you know, dialogue.
Yeah, sure.
He says to the evil guy, "Why do you strike your fellow?" Right? "Why do you strike your fellow?
You better shut up before I hit you first."
Right. "Vayomer." Oh, no. He gives him the truest.
It's the really Jewish answer.
Jewish answer ever. Like, you know this book
is
real. Why
are you going to kill me like you did the Egyptian?
No, first.
All right.
He replied, "Who set you as a dignitary, a ruler, and a judge over us?"
Right.
"Who put you as a boss, Mr. Moses guy?" And then he says, "Do you propose to murder me as you murdered the Egyptian?"
Well,
every Israeli politician needs to read that every morning. Okay?
Yeah, exactly.
Because that is Israeli and Jewish politics.
But it's important for the non-Hebrew reader to appreciate the depth of the parallelism here. It's because, as we pointed out, that Moshe looked this way and that way, Vayaki ein ish. And your shot that he saw that nobody else was going to do this. There was no ish, b'makom she'ein ish. And here, the rejoinder he gets, v'yomer, misamcha le'ish, sar v'shofet. Like, who made you the man?
Right.
Right, and you see that this is the challenge that you're pointing out, is that you take a position of responsibility and leadership because it's the right thing to do,
mm-hmm.
not because you think that people will see you as having done the right thing.
Right, absolutely. Right?
That is it, and if you have hopes that people will see you as having done the right thing, then don't do it.
And that it's not necessarily rewarding. I think there's a Gemara like that. I don't remember exactly how it goes, but basically, how does it go? It's like somebody's made... Somebody's given honor or power, and so he's like, "Thank you for honoring me." And the other rabbi's like, "Honoring you, I just put a yoke of a hellish yoke of burden on you."
Well, look at what lays in store for Moshe. Right. This is a very difficult journey ahead.
Right.
And in the end of the day, he doesn't even get to see the fruits of his labor.
Right. Well. Right. Not
he sees in a visionary sense.
Yeah. I think Moshe Rabbeinu is Yismach Moshe b'matnat chelko, right?
Okay.
Like Moshe is happy with his incredible lot. And again, I'm a little bit like I try to contemplate what it is. What is a Moses? What is this person? And it's I don't know. It's I think, by the way, that my Christian brothers and sisters have a certain awe towards their God, deity, you know, the way that they understand the founder of their religion. But again, here the difference is ours is fallible, real, has
skin.
Right,
he's got flesh and blood.
Right, right.
A human being like you and I, who reached the highest level that a human being is going to reach, but a human being like you and I.
Right. Okay, we have to take a little break right now, right? We're going to be back here at the Pardes Institute in just a little bit. Rabbi Mike has got an appointment, and I've got some more preparation stuff to do. So we're going to take a little break here. Maybe we'll ask our beloved Ben Bresky, the greatest sound man of them all, who I've been on his team now for 15 years, I think, and he's been on my team for 15 years, together to put in a little, I don't know about Muzak, but I think maybe Mozak, okay? little Jewish music here. We'll decide together what that's going to be. But we're going to be right back to continue the Moses story and the faithful meeting between God and Moses on Mount Sinai in preparation for the work ahead in Egypt and finally the Exodus and the receiving of the Torah. So we'll be right back here on the Yishai Fleischer Show on the Land of Israel Network here in Yerushalayim, Ir HaKodesh, the holy and eternal city, with Rabbi Mike Foer. We'll be right back. Stay tuned, stay strong, and shalom.
1, 2, 3, 4.
And we're back here on the Shai Fleischer Show, and we have Rabbi Mike Foer with us. Rabbi Mike, how was your meeting just now?
It was productive, actually.
Good, good, good.
Thank you very
much. I'm happy. And I really feel happy for these young people here that have your time. And I have another meeting in about 25 minutes, and we have to get through some big stuff.
Yeah, this is big stuff. No pressure.
Okay. So
When we last left Moses,
he first met Jewish politics and what it's like to lead a nation, and really the great yoke and challenge of that. His impulse, the right impulse, the one that I would have chosen, is to run away.
Get out of town.
run away. But when we say run away here, we also mean run away from everything that he's known. We mean also running away from his status. We mean that here's a person who was somebody and becomes just nobody. He was the prince of Egypt, and now he becomes really nobody. And one of the most beautiful, tiny little scenes in the Torah, and sometimes I want to say the tinier they are, the bigger they are. These tiny scenes in the Torah are like, they are just
gems.
They're gems, and they're huge in what's really going on there. And so Moses figures out that it is known that he killed the Egyptian. Pharaoh wants to kill him. It says literally that Vakesh Laharoget Moshe, that he was looking to kill Moses. Moses runs away from Pharaoh, and he goes to Midian, and he sits at the bar, the well. Okay, that's where you meet people.
The watering hole. Just call it the watering hole.
That's right. The watering hole. That's where you meet folks. Now, the Midianite priest had seven daughters. Okay, seven daughters.
We call that Abu Banat.
Right, that's right. He's got a lot of daughters. Now, these daughters are, sadly, he's got no sons, so therefore his daughters are the
Shepherdesses.
And they are out there. Now, I actually saw the next scene on National Geographic. I saw this scene. I literally watched a show about how women are oftentimes kicked out from the well by, mean, bad controllers of that well, of the water source.
Saw it all happen.
Right, I saw it happen. I'm not even...
Was there a Moses in that scene?
There was no Moses, but there was I was like, no way. It's like these women are walking, 10 kilometers, they're trying to draw the water, and there's some bad dude there. He says, get out of here, and that tribe, that family will die.
Yep.
So, get it. We're in the desert here, and it's hot. And they come to the well, and these other shepherds kick them out. Moshe stands up and he saves them. What does he do exactly? Does he hit the other guys? Does he just scare them? What does he do? It is not clear.
It's a testimony that as long as you're not a passive bystander, that it's much easier to drive off the bully than people usually take credit for.
Uh-huh. Okay, that's good. That's a good point.
This is one of the original bully bystander victim moments in the Torah.
Right.
And it's just going to show you that, by the by, this is a posture that Am Yisrael knows will bring redemption.
Right.
And don't play dumb before evil.
Right. Okay, great. And Moses is the dude to lead. And my contention is that this moment is the leadership moment for him, because we already saw that he had courage vis-a-vis the Egyptian. We know he can say truth, give truth to power. That's basically what the rest of this book is about, or half of it is truth to power, right? Maybe that's the name of the show today, but no, maybe next Torah portions is more truth to power. But okay, so he stood up for his brothers. There was an element of a self-interest.
Sure.
Here, he's in Midian, sees a strong shepherd, which he should align himself with, instead of these weak women. Who needs them? They're obviously disempowered in society. Plus, I don't know the backstory. Maybe they deserve it. I really don't know. I shouldn't really get involved. I don't know the local customs, et cetera, et cetera,
et
cetera.
Don't rock the boat.
Don't rock the boat. And who am I, Bichlal, here? I don't have any status here.
I'm just an innocent bystander.
Right. And Moses shows that he is a fighter for truth, and a courageous fighter for truth, wherever he is.
Mm-hmm.
And that says, and that brings the bridges what we talk about on the show a lot, the universal and the particularistic. I'm for the Jews, but I'm also for justice.
And in many ways, I believe it's why this story is a key lead up to God revealing himself to Moshe, because Moshe is going to take Am Yisrael out of Egypt. It's a very personal, very national story. It's the birth of our nation. The same, and he's going to give us the Torah at Sinai, but to what end? Universal redemption. It's going to be a long process, but it's precisely the dynamic that you're laying out here.
So those two stories, and okay, Moses is going to now get married,
Mazel tov.
Mazel tov, right? And they, and here in the Prince of Egypt, they do a great job kind of showing who Jethro is. He's this jolly idolater who's tried every kind of idolatry with the seven daughters and all that kind of stuff. And now he is, you know, kind of on the way towards seeing the living God, takes Moses in, and he gives him a wife. He has two children with her. And then Pharaoh dies, or the king of Egypt dies, and God hears the outcry of the Jewish people. And we have here the formulation, Vayiskor Elohim et Brito, et Avraham et Yitzchak ve et Yaakov. This is a refrain that we're going to hear over and over again, including a very seminal pasuk coming up. And basically, God is going to hear the cries, or in other words, time's up. Okay? It's time. It's redemption time. Mm-hmm. It's go time. And Moses is still, you know, in the kind of ashram and the far away, like he's by himself. He's a
wandering shepherd.
What is it? He what was the phrase in the '60s? Drop out.
Tune in, turn on, drop out.
Yeah, that's it. He tuned out, dropped out. Okay, he's out of that thing.
He's out. That whole Egypt thing. That's yesterday.
Yeah, it's out. And you know, and yeah, I know it's my brothers, but what am I supposed to do? I can't do anything about it, and so therefore the world is icky. I tried. The world is icky. My own Jews turned against me. Forget it. I'm out. But God
says,
I got my wife and my sheep and my mountain here. It's all good. It's all good. I'm all by myself. Very Jewish mode. However, God is going to turn to him and offer him a job.
I mean, it's a kind of a strong arm offer.
It's a strong arm offer in which he's going to actually, the rabbis tell us, is going to argue against taking this job for seven whole days.
Yeah.
7 days he says no to God.
Yeah. Huh?
Now that's Jewish.
Well,
that's Jewish.
I mean, it's Moshe through and through, and in many ways, it's just convincing God more and more that Moshe is the man for the job, because he's got to stand up in front of Pharaoh, who thinks that he's a god. So God's basically going to tell him, well, after you've argued with me, who I am God, for 7 days, so you're clearly fit to go argue with Pharaoh, who thinks he is.
Very good. I like that very much. That's excellent. And God is going to appear to him first from a lowly thorn bush. There's many explanations to this lowly burning thorn bush. One is that it's a lowly, as I said, it's not a grand thing. One of the explanations is the Jewish people are in trouble, so I'm not going to appear in a big, beautiful thing. I'm appearing in this thorny little thing. I think another thing is maybe the thorn bush is actually the Jewish people, or like their role in this world. It's like this like thorny.
Just kind of like, poking at you. There's an important piece.
By the way, I just want you to know the thorn bushes, this is a desert reference. Thorn bushes are what Bedouins use often to start fires.
Sure, yeah.
Okay, they are the great, of course, you know, but like they're great fire material, especially
the great tinder and kindling.
Right.
They're not actually great fuel.
No, they're not great fuel, and they burn out quickly.
Yes.
They burn out quickly.
Hence the image here.
Right, that it's not burning out.
This is not a flash in the pan, says God.
Right.
Right? And there's a moment here that it's important to me to note is that it's when God speaks to Moshe, it's in response to this beautiful line when the Moshe walks by this burning bush and it says, "V'yomer Moshe, asura na ve'et amareh hagadol hazeh." He's like, I'm going to turn it aside and look at this. Madua lo yivar asneh. Why isn't that bush burning? And that's the moment. It says, "Vayar Hashem kisar lirot." God sees that he turned aside to look, and that's when God calls out to him. Why? Because the whole power dynamic in Moshe as the bystander and the leadership that we laid out there hinges on this ability of Moshe to actually see. You know, what's her name? Maria Montessori, founder of the Montessori system, says that we only see that which we're ready to take responsibility for.
Mm-hmm.
And that most of us are blind to what's going on around us. And mm-hmm. we see here, literally, that Moshe actually saw.
That's a very deep phrase. Can you say that again?
Yes, we only see that which we're ready to take responsibility for.
That's powerful.
And this is what we're seeing here is that Moshe says this doesn't fit. Most of us, when something doesn't fit the way we see the world or we want to see the world, we literally don't see it. We walk right by.
Right.
We walk by the people in need. We walk by the people in pain. We walk by the people who are offering us incredible opportunities. It's not all bad. We miss all that stuff too.
Right.
But Moshe doesn't miss it.
Right.
Because he's ready to take responsibility. And that's why God says, okay, I'm going to give you more responsibility than you ever dreamed.
So he's looking at this thing. And then when God reveals himself, he says, I am the God Anochi, it's Anochi, by the way, means it's like the real me. It's the me.
Right, right. It's the inner me.
Right. Anochi, Elohei Avicha, I am the God of your forefathers, as we said in the beginning of the show. Elohei Avraham, Elohei Yitzchak, Elohei Yaakov. Again, the forefathers are mentioned. And then Moshe hides his face because he doesn't want to look onto God.
It's a dramatic moment.
Right. He knows when to look at the mystery, but then when the mystery is revealed, not to look at it. Yeah, there's a place where you're not supposed to look.
Yeah, where there's a depth, and then what does God tell him to do? Right, he tells him to take off his shoe here, right? He says, well, it's right before that. Shal nalecha mi'al aglecha. Right? It's, one answer to this is like,
take
is
off
like
your shoes, you're in a
special spot. Special place.
Right.
But another answer to this is that when he says to him, Hamakom asher ata omer alav admat kodeshu, wherever you're standing is actually a holy place. Mm-hmm. Take off your shoe. Take off that thing that stands between you and me.
Right.
Says God to Moshe.
So a few things on that. First thing is that there's a medrash that says the Temple Mount jumped to the Mount Sinai. And this
Sinai and the Temple Mount are always being bunched together by the medrash.
Right. And this is the Temple. This is Sinai.
Yes.
Okay, this is Mount Sinai. This is the future Mount Sinai. God is going to tell him, this is the same
place. The sign is that your people will come and serve me in this place.
Here. We're having a pre-meeting here.
Yes.
Okay,
warming the place up.
Right, but the big thing is coming.
The big
right
show
here.
Is
it's like, you know, imagine like
come.
You're like a big rock star and you come into on the stage before, you know, you have some of those rock star videos, you know, like a Guns N' Roses will come to a
make their mark.
Right, they come to a stadium before the show.
Uh-huh.
And you see them setting up, you know, the whole show. This is like the setup. The other thing is I was thinking about this that he says this is the Holy Land. This place is the Holy Land. And I realized that there's something, Torah, this is a non-Zionist perspective. Torah is what makes a place holy, okay? Torah, and he says, this is a place of Torah. This is a makom Torah. And the last thing I want to say is what Rabbi Tendler always tells us, amazing thing. Rabbi Tendler, you should live and be well, Rabbi Moshe David Tendler. He tells us, he says, why do we take off our leather shoes on the Temple Mount or in Yom Kippur? He says, because leather is the animal. Animal eats the grass. The grass controls the earth and the rocks. So the leather that we wear actually symbolizes a hierarchy. We are standing on top of the leather, which stands on top of the plants, which stands on top of the thing. We're the boss. And on Yom Kippur or on the Temple Mount, you take that off and you say, I'm not the boss. And so Moshe Rabbeinu had to kind of also hear, you're not the boss. I'm the boss. And yet Moshe Rabbeinu does not succumb so easily, even though he might take off his shoes. Still, he's going to argue. And his argument isn't, who are you? You're the boss, but who am I as a vessel? I am not a worthy vessel. Vayomer Moshe Elokim, mi anochi? Ki alecha paro. Who am I to take the Jews out? Go to Pharaoh and take out the Jews. And God says, I'm going to be with you. And he's going to use this word eheyeh in various ways. Ki eheyeh imach. I'm going to be with you. And then later on, he's going to say, I'm going to be with your mouth. And then Moses says, well, okay, fine. Okay, Pharaoh, I get it. You're going to be God. I'm going to be your representative a representative of God to Pharaoh. Fine. But what about the Jewish people? I've already had experience with them. They're not exactly
tough
crowd. What should I say to them? So this is a good one. I'm going to say to them, the God of your forefathers sent me to you. And they'll say, what's your name? What's his name?
He knows what's coming.
Right. I'm going to say the God of your forefathers is coming to you. They're going to be like,
which God?
Yeah. What's
the password?
What's the password? And then God says one of the most, I don't know, you know, like shocking and intimate on the other hand, words of the whole Torah where he says, "Vayomer Elokim el Moshe, eheyeh asher eheyeh. I will be that which I will be." Tell the children of Israel, that which will be sent me to you.
So there's so much, and right. I know that we have a limited time, but it's important to me to point out two things. First of all, this is the only name of God which is in the first person, which means that no one else can actually say it. And not just because of some sort of religious hesitancy.
Linguistically speaking,
right? I cannot speak unless we get to the depth of it, which is that it's not a name that's spoken.
But he does say, tell them.
Right.
That's
the second half. And we don't ever see Moshe telling them this.
No.
Except in the end of the day, the giving of the whole Torah is the telling of this name. Because what's God saying? He's saying, you're not other than me. You are my expression in the world, and I'm going to give you the Torah in order that you can bring out the Ayyeb, which is within you, the God. We're all created in the image of God, after all. He says, you want to know what to tell them? You tell them that you'll know who I am once you receive this Torah and you live it right. out through history.
Right.
It's
right,
not a
right.
name I can give you, like it's a piece of information. This is a way of being my people in the world.
Right. I love what you're saying. I would say the same thing, but just a little bit different. I am process. I am not what you see right now. What you see is not what you get. You will endure things. There will be a Holocaust. There will be bad things. But like you said just now, like I am a final revelation.
Right, but the key is that and that you are not other than I, meaning that I will become that through your living in the world. Right? This is the choice that God has made in entering into the covenant with Am Yisrael.
I have to say, just for a second, to pause and say we have to pray for Refuah Shlemah of Netanel Felber, who is still very much suffering with a bullet in the brain.
Yep.
And my friend Yehuda Cohen told me that Yehuda Cohen's wife is cousins with.
I didn't know that.
She's a Felber. He told me that his friends went to the hospital and did Kriyat HaTorah for him for Shabbos, and that he opened his eyes for a second. But when you get a bullet in one of the sides of your brain, that really
it's
pretty damaging. So we really have to pray for him.
It's in Netanel Ilan Ben Shena Tzipora.
That's right, Netanel Ilan Ben Shena Tzipora, Netanel Felber, and others. It irks me that, speaking of Ehayet, like the timeline just keeps going, yeah. and then there's people behind in the yeah. hospital and in life.
No, we've spoken about this before.
It hurts me a lot. And I dread and fear and welcome the day of Yom HaZikaron when we like go back into the dark archives. As I said to you before, for me, Yom HaZikaron, you don't have to do anything. You just, in Israel, all you have to do is listen to the radio or watch TV.
Read the names. Yeah.
No, but they tell you the stories. And it's just like, okay. Anyway, all right. Another one is, he says, here's a very important one for somebody who works in Chevron. It says, Vayomer Odelim. God says another thing, El Moshe, to Moses. Kotomar Mishra. This is what you should say to the children of Israel. Hashem, the Tetragrammaton, Elokei Avotechem, the God of your forefathers, Elokei Avraham, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, Shalchani Lechem, sent me to you. Zeshmi Le'olam, this is my name forever. And this is my memory, the way I'm to be remembered for generation after generation.
You hear past, present, and future right. coming together in all this. God says, listen, you want to freeze frame me and ask what's my name. First, I'm going to tell you, I'm not yet that which I will be.
Right.
But since that's a little bit too much for you to absorb, I will tell you that their past is coming due. I made a promise to Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And furthermore, your obligation through Zikaron is to tie together past and future in your present decision. Are you going out or not? Because let's remember, as we'll speak about it, the majority of Am Yisrael does not leave.
Then the next part of the discussion between Moses and God is the program of the plagues. There yep. will be things. There will be a show.
Signs and wonders.
There'll be signs and wonders, and I want you to be the purveyor of this because you're going to make a lot of movies about this.
That's right, and you got to make it good, Moshe.
You got to make it good. You got to make it a show, and the show is going to be remembered forever.
By the way, this is not a small thing. It's not simple theatrics. It's the power of the story.
Right.
If it's not done in this way, then people will always believe it'll be something that remains in the past, whereas the power of the story is it's something which is ever-present.
Right.
And therefore, he can keep influencing the future.
And he's going to lay out to him some of the chapters in the story. For example,
he gives him the Cliff's Notes,
right? Because Moses yet again is going to doubt God. He says, "Well, they're not going to believe me. They're not going to listen to me. That you showed up. That you showed yourself to me. It's like a Muhammad thing. Lahavdil. It's like Muhammad. You know, it's like God talked to me. And for 12 years, he was in Mecca, and nobody believed him until he moved to Medina, conquered, and then went
suddenly
came back to
everyone's
Mecca.
Everyone's like, whoa,
yeah,
God okay? talked to him,
right? Yeah. Oh, that sword is right at my throat. Yes, yes, yes. I believe you very much. Anyway, but God will give him signs, and there's going to be three signs here. One of them is going to be the famous chuck your staff down. And it's going to become a snake, and Moses gets afraid of the snake. Here's where I think is actually the more important part, which is God says to him, now send out your hand and grab it by its tail. If you know snakes, you don't grab a snake by the tail, you grab it by the head. Grab it by the tail, and then it will become once again a staff in your a rod in your hand.
Here's a thought to ponder for you from your pre-sheet model.
Yeah.
I think this is the first reappearance of the snake since the garden.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. As far as I can tell, mm-hmm. that snake was there, and then he was gone, and suddenly...
That's good.
Back in the hands of motion.
Right. That's very
not
good.
Not really sure what to make of it. Anybody has a thought on that, you can share it with me.
Good. Okay. And you can write to RavMike@thelandofisrael.com or Yishai@thelandofisrael.com. That's a great point. We're definitely going to... Yeah, it's good. That's
just a ponder.
It's a pondering moment for this Shabbat. My thought is actually the snake is also Egypt. It's this sea creature, and there's other...
The tanin, right, which the tanin. It gets referred to as later.
Right.
But here it's the nachash.
Right. But I'll go back and forth. But grab it by the tail. I will give you the power to deal with this giant, you know, Egypt.
Right.
You'll be able to grab it by the tail.
And you will show that it's harmless, like you said.
Right.
If you grab it behind the back of the neck like you should to a snake, you're showing you know it's dangerous.
Right.
And just being careful. You grab it by the end of the tail, you're showing... No.
You don't have any bite in you.
Yeah.
Right. And the next sign is going to be the put your hand in your cloak and take it out. Oh, my gosh. Now it's going to – Moses is going to see that his hand is totally sickly with –
Biblical leprosy.
Biblical leprosy. As I've told you before, tzarat is the word psoriasis. It's the same word. Okay. But like all white. Here again, my what I'd like to say is maybe it's not that your hand became – riddled with this disease. Rather, the second part, which is return it back, take it out, and it's well again. Meaning to say, you may deal with a people who's sickly, who's exilic, who's full of sin, etc. Take him out of this thing, and you could bring him back to health.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. And finally, spill the blood out. Take water and spill it out on the earth. It'll become like blood. And here, it took me a lot of years to think about this one. What the sign means, and I think what the sign could mean. Is that you, Pharaoh, drowned the children in the Nile, but you did it quietly. Nobody knew about it. We'll expose you for what you are, which is a mass murderer. You think you're this high and mighty moral culture. We'll show what blood you spilled, what you did. And that's exactly this water, this clean, clear water of life. You filled it with blood, and we'll show that, and you'll have to drink that blood. Mm. Okay, just a thought. In any case, says Moses, I am heavy of speech and heavy of tongue. I have never found in any place that it says that he was a stutterer. This stuttering business I've never seen. What
well,
does
the
he
midrash.
Say? There's a midrash like that? Okay, what I see is he says, I'm heavy of speech, which is, I am the kind of guy who
says... Say it like it is.
Right, I'm very blunt. I'm too blunt. I say to a guy, hey, you're a Rasha. Why are you hitting your friend? Like,
It didn't go so well.
I'm too much of a straight talker. But God says to him a theological phrase, which is, well, who do you think makes mouths?
Yisam Pelish.
Right, who is the...
The mouth maker.
Right. Do you like those molecules that make you up? Because I made that, okay? He says to him... Anyway, I'm going to be with your mouth. However, at the end, says Moses, do me a favor, shlach na biati shlach, which is a tricky way of saying, please, my Lord, send through whomever you will send, i.e.
Not me.
Right, send somebody else. Then it says God got angry at him. Famously, where that anger went is hidden, because usually when there's a word, veichar af, that kind of flaring up, the flare
bad
is...
Bad news follows quickly behind
right,
it.
There's a flare.
Yes.
There's a fire, flare. Right? There's a fire. In any case, God says to him, guess what? I'm sending you a diplomat. And it's your brother. It's your own brother. Okay? And it says that when he sees you, he will be happy in his heart. What's famous about that? Like, about Aaron? Like, if he knew, he was so humble, Aaron. He was so happy that his brother got this job, that he was happy. And had he known how nice the Torah would have written about him, that he was happy in his heart that his brother got this position, he would have you know, come out with drums and with
I mean, there's such depth in this. I mean, you know, the Midrash says that really what Moshe was holding out was for Aaron's dignity. Moshe was saying, Aaron's the older brother, you should send him, and he's going to be jealous. And then the Torah reveals to us, is like, no, Aaron's not jealous. He's on the program. Right. He's happy for you because you're doing what you need to do.
Yeah.
But to me, the simplest, most beautiful part is that up until now, the entire book of Genesis was about family problems. And here, bound up with the beginning of redemption, is we finally have two brothers that love each other.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's a fundamental shift which will follow us through the rest of the book of Shemot.
Well, this triumvirate is the team.
Yeah.
This is the team. It's going to be Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam. This is the team. One family, you know, this amazing...
They have bumps along the way.
Sure,
but,
they have bumps. And yet they... And yet.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet, yeah. Amazing things. Just a few more little points, and that is... Moshe's going to go to Jethro. He says, I got to go back down to Egypt and deal with my the welfare of my brothers.
The king and the whole...
Right. Yeah. Probably lays out the whole story to him. Says Jethro to Moshe, Lech l'shalom, go to peace.
Good luck, kid.
Jethro, every phrase of Jethro's in the Bible is a blessing, is a goodness, is a just...
He's the first one to say Baruch Hashem.
That's right. He's just all the time, or he says to his daughters, bring this man, feed him.
Like, come on, he helped you out of the well.
Right, like he's just, there's like something about Jethro, which I think Prince of Egypt captured well. There's something jolly and good about him. There's a goodness about him all the time.
It's not for naught that the portion in which we receive the Torah is named for him.
That's right. Okay, then sadly we don't have enough time to cover this in a deep way, but the next thing is the little effort to murder Moses by God.
Right.
What?
Question. Strange incident that to this day has remained unresolved.
Okay. And that is, we talked about this last year, which is that along the way at the motel at night, God seeks to hurt Moses or his son. Something happens there. A snake does. Okay, you know what?
I'll say this quickly.
My explanation is, here's the phrase. It was on the way in the lodging that Hashem encountered him, Moses, and sought to put him to death. My explanation is the following. This is actually the anger that we saw flared up before that kind of disappeared, and that is like this. I've asked you for 7 days to come save my kids, my children in Egypt. You have refused to do so. And so now I want you to feel the pain. I want you to feel the pain of what it means to lose a son. Okay, this is Yishai's explanation, and here's how it goes. I know this is not exactly the standard text, but what he says is, V'omar alecha, I said to you, Moses, shlachet b'ni v'avduni, I said to you, Moses, send my children, get my children, and they will serve me. V'temayen l'shalcho, you refuse to actually send them out. Now I'm going to kill your firstborn son because you've got to feel the pain. Okay. The general reading is that this is what you got to say to Pharaoh,
right,
which is, my firstborn son is Israel and you didn't send them out. Now I'm going to kill your firstborn son, which was what happens. But another alternative reading, which is plausible, which is, I am now going to kill your firstborn son. And this explains what happens next, which is that he almost loses a son until Tzipporah, his incredible wife, does the circumcision ceremony right there, touches the foreskin to the feet, the blood is there, and she says, you caused my bridegroom's bloodshed. So he released him, and then she said, a bridegroom's bloodshed was because of circumcision.
Yep.
Yes, excellent.
Note to self, we're going to have to think about that.
Yeah, we're going to have to think about that. We're going to talk about that. Let's finish off, and that is Aaron and Moses meet. They meet, and they embrace, and he kissed them. And Moses told Aaron everything that God sent him to do. They gathered the elders in Egypt, and they showed him the signs, and the nation believed that it was time for God's redemption of the Jewish people, and that God saw their affliction, and they bowed to God. And then, So everything is good. The setup is great. Next thing you know, we're going to have the Exodus, but not quite, because when Moses and Aaron come to Pharaoh, they try to explain to him this stuff. He says to them, you're obviously a troublesome lot. You're a revolutionary types.
You got too much free time on your
hands. And what he says to them is, okay, we're going to make life even harder. Double down. Right? And people should know that whenever you have a political issue, a problem, and you're going to face somebody and you're going to try to undermine them or something like that, subvert them, just know this.
Evil always doubles down.
Right. They double down. Like, just know that if you're going to call out evil, like, don't think they're going to go down quietly.
No,
to the
listen,
night.
Misguided people change their mind, but the truly evil don't say, oh, I'm sorry. Oh, I wasn't supposed to be doing that. I'll just go over here and do my thing. No, it's because it's going to hold on to power. And this is one of the reasons that this is a shattering story. It's not a simple one.
No, not at all. It's right, and that's the ahayah part. That's the ahayah part. Like
hang on tight for this
right,
process.
Hang on tight because because it's going to be shaky. The wheel's going to shake. The foreman of the children of Israel came and cried out to Pharaoh, saying, "Why do you do this to your servants? Straw is not given to your servants, yet they tell us make bricks. Behold, your servants are beaten, and it is a sin for your people." Right, liberalism. Mm-hmm. He said, you are lazy, lazy. Therefore you say, let us go and bring offerings to Hashem. Now go to work. Straw will not be given to you, but you must provide the quota of bricks.
Get back to work.
Okay. And so people are in trouble. And of course, back to first principles, the people are going to turn against Moses. And they encountered Moses and Aaron standing opposite them, and they left as they left Pharaoh's presence. They said to him, meaning he just came out of talking truth to power, the children of Israel are going to say, may Hashem look upon you and judge, for you have made our very scent abhorrent in the eyes of Pharaoh and the eyes of his servants, to place a sword in their hands to murder us. Moses, passing the buck, returned to Hashem and said, my Lord, why have you brought harm to your people? Why have you sent me? You did not... you did not rescue your people. Instead, it's gotten only worse. Hashem says to Moses, now you will see what I shall do to Pharaoh, for through a strong hand will he send them out, and with a strong hand he will drive them from his land. Meaning to say, the show is just beginning.
There's something very deep and I find painful in Moshe's interaction here at the end, because as you said, there's a process, and you have to hold out for the end. And, you know, Rashi here brings the Midrash that says that this is why Moshe doesn't go into the land.
Right.
Right?
The first phrase where he's kind of giving a hard time to God about his behavior.
Well, and because he's unable to see the end of the process and in the suffering of the moment. And in many ways, it seems to me that that's the nature of life in the land. The nature of life in the land is because it's fully embodied, because it's real, so that the process is going to be painful, and it's going to be long and slow and hard. And God's basically saying to Moshe, you're not going to be the right leader for that. Mm-hmm. You can bring them out. You mm-hmm. can guide them in the desert in order that they could receive the purity of the Torah. But when it comes to the work of the embodiment and the building and the conquest and the failures and the setbacks and the forwards, that's not going to be you. Mm-hmm. And it showed itself here for the first time. Mm-hmm. Which is really, it's a hard thing to hear.
That's a great explanation. But the fallibility of Moses is exposed, and that's the beauty of it.
Of course.
That's the beauty of Judaism, the fallibility of these people, the truth, the fight, the sweat, the tears.
The reality.
The reality of it. And that's right. I mean, I love what you just talked about, because, you know, just that, you know, at first steps, Moses shows a certain, and he says something, but that's going to be remembered for you.
And it goes to what we were speaking both on air and off about, is that idealists don't build countries, right? Meaning idealists can contribute a lot to vision, and they can, and certainly breathe life into culture, but the process of building is a messy process, which must be, you have to believe that you can carry it through and not need it to be perfect right now.
Okay, folks, we are out of time, but we have encountered the complexity of the personality of Moses, and try to keep him real. And at the same time, understand, like, another realness is understand that, try to make him real, but understand that you cannot fathom also what this person Moses is.
It's so important. You don't have to take something off its pedestal to make it real.
Right.
Right. You can still revere that which is real.
That's right. And that's the real reverence. That's the real reverence, and that's why it's so important to come close to a great tzaddik and great people in general, and to see them close up. I had the chance of seeing the Lubavitcher Rebbe in my life, and I've also seen Prime Minister Netanyahu at his residence, etc. You know what I mean? To be close to great people and to see their actions.
Did he offer you a cigar?
Huh? There was no cigar or ice cream, but it was a great and very interesting evening. But he also offered himself, which was a great thing. In any case, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleisher Show, Rabbi Mike Foyer. Thank you so much for joining us today here in Yerushalayim, Yer HaKodesh. Please check out Rabbi Mike's other show, which is The Jewish Story. And
almost end of season three.
Almost
season
end
two.
Of season. That's season right. And Rabbi Mike has these amazing seasons and an amazing tour through Jewish history and really global history at the time as well. Very powerful stuff, and really a lot of people have been moved by it. So you can email Rabbi Mike at RavMike@thelandofisrael.com or his Facebook page, Rav Mike.
That's right.
At Facebook.
You'll see Jewish Story Podcast.
The Jewish Story Podcast there. You'll see it there. You'll see a lot of stuff. And join also this network, which has great other shows that are, I think, making a real consciousness difference. So that's the Land of Israel Network. And yeah, check out all the other great guys that are on this show. And that's it. I have to rush, so I just want to say to you, stay tuned, because a lot of you have written to me saying you want to hear more of Malka, and she wasn't with me in Brooklyn last week. And I don't know what happened the week before. The bottom line is Malka is back, Bezrat Hashem, in the next part of the show. So stay tuned for that. In the meantime, stay tuned, stay strong, stay connected. We'll be back with more. Shalom al Yisrael. God bless you.
Hi, folks. Josh Haston here, host of Israel Uncensored on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com. This week, an exclusive interview with Dr. Seth Franzman, op-ed editor at the Jerusalem Post. He has been to Turkey, he's been to Iraq, he's been to Kurdistan to cover regional conflict here in the Middle East.
It may not immediately affect us, but the larger picture is that with the U.S. reducing its footprint, and I think also leading to a lot of questions about how erratic the Trump administration is becoming.
Hear what he has to say about the U.S. decision to pull U.S. troops out of Syria. Don't miss the show. Exclusively here on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com. That's Israel Uncensored with Josh Haston this week. Don't miss it.
Okay, and we're back here on the Yishai Fleischer Show. Shalom. I just got signaled from Malka to keep it down since we're recording in the house. Malka Fleischer joins me on this segment. Shalom, Malka.
You're waking up the children.
Don't worry about it. They know that we got to do radio for the world, and people are listening globally, internationally, and around the world.
And as well as worldwide.
That's right. So shalom and welcome back to the Yishai Fleischer Show. Malka Fleischer, thank you for joining. You were just telling me that El Al has flights to Vegas and back now?
So it looks like...
Direct flights?
So El Al, there's been a lot of stories about El Al recently. I think they're trying to be more competitive-ish. Like, they're not going to be the cheaper airline or anything like that, but I think they're trying to be more competitive, and now they're opening direct flights to Las Vegas. Now, I did not know that Israelis go to Las Vegas.
Everybody goes to Vegas, Malka.
Everybody goes to Vegas?
Yeah.
Israelis go to Vegas?
Everybody goes to Vegas,
dude. Do they go to Dallas? Because that would really help me.
Nobody goes to Dallas. No, we go to Vegas to gamble, dude. Vegas, where there's shows and gambling, you know?
I never heard of Israelis talk about that. But then again, I went to Ukraine to visit the Baal Shem Tov. I didn't know Israelis go there either. And it turns out that people are flocking there every year.
Yeah.
I think Israelis travel in general. They want to go around.
You know, I could talk a lot about El Al because I actually am a frequenter on El Al and I am a frequent flyer on El Al. And what people, I don't usually talk about this, but I actually try to fly only El Al, meaning to say like
internationally.
And the truth is that I like El Al, and I'm used to it, and I'm like, now, there are many things to complain about. The seats are tighter, and the point system is not as good, and the entertainment system, I've just given up on it in general already.
Ooh,
completely.
Wow.
But like, I'm already like...
Angry staff?
No.
No?
No, the staff is wonderful.
Oh,
The staff is great. The staff is always nice, courteous, pleasant, young, fun, smiley. No, the staff is great. That's exactly one of the things. The staff is nice. The staff is very nice on El Al. Kids.
You also feel that if anything happens in midair, that one of them will just like Krav Maga the person, and then you're fine.
First thing, there's more security. Everybody knows that. But and there's like an air marshal with like a gun somewhere there, with like specialized bullets that don't break the hull, all kinds of stuff like that. That's security wise. But then on top of that, I like the food. I like being in a big Jewish airplane. I like that you can daven and nobody makes a big deal out of it. I like that kids can feel cool with a frequent flyer like me sitting next to them, and I'm not going to start, you know, giving them a hard time because it's Israel. It's like, meaning to say, it's a family type
we're all
atmosphere.
We're all like us.
Right.
It's us.
So
it's just us.
I sat down in the airplane right next to this French guy in a good seat. And
on your last flight,
on
you
my
just
last
came
flight
back
home,
from,
right,
from
Brooklyn.
A trip,
so I was like, so the guy starts saying something about El Al. I said to him, Javier, I only fly El Al and I love it. And here's why. And I showed him. And then throughout the flight, he's like, you know what? Look, you're right about El Al. He's like, look, this guy's davening and he feels comfortable. You know what? He said, the kids feel good. He's like, the food is kosher. You know what? I am comfortable here. And he got into this long conversation with this other French airline hostess. What's the proper nomenclature?
Stewardess.
No, there's...
Flight steward?
Flight
attendant.
Anyway, so it was just... I'm telling you that, like, I'm happy. When I get in that chair in El Al, I'm happy. And I love the name El Al.
Yeah, that was brilliant. That was a stroke of like
right,
Ruach HaKodesh.
Because it could have been like Israel or Israel.
I like Israel was cute.
I don't.
There was an airline,
right? But like, Israel. Or Israel Airlines or something like that. But like, El Al, to the heights. That's what that means. El Al,
to above.
To above. It's just so great. I love the colors of the airline, and I. By the way, the both the food and the service is great.
Can I also say that?
One more thing. You have never. Now that I've flown around the world and I have flown in different airlines, including Cathay, okay? Cathay, when they land...
You have not flown Japan Air.
I have not flown Japan
Air. I'm sorry. Now, it's been a while, but right. I flew Japan Air. That is one incredible airline.
Okay, this Cathay Air, nice airline. Everything's fine and dandy. No problems. Except when they land the hunk of metal on the tarmac, they thump it every time. Boom! They thump it on the ground. I'm telling
every
you,
every time?
I was there like... how many flights did I take? I think at least two flights, right, in and out of Australia. And both times they thumped it on a perfectly nice day. Boom. El Al, I don't know what it is, but it's these Israeli airline pilots. This is what happens. And when they're in Israeli, like, jet school, the Israelis are like, look, look, tire, look, we don't have a lot of these, okay? So you land this thing like a sweet puppy,
just
okay?
Just tap it,
okay? Like a little lady.
Just kiss it, a little smooch.
Just kiss it, a little smooch, okay? Just land it, okay, on the ground. And Ella lands these...
They're like, have we landed?
Maka, the last landing was like pulling out a tissue out of... And I mean like a Puffs Plus, you know what I mean? It was like pulling out a Puffs Plus. That was the feeling. I was like, shit. I was like, what? I mean, and I'm used
to... Are we on the ground?
I'm used to their soft landings. This was absurd. And I go, when I come up to, you know, and then, of course, all airlines do this. They make you do the walk of shame, right? There's perfect exits in the back of the aeroplane, right? No, you got to walk through a business
class.
And then... peek at first class and just know what a poor sucker you are. Anyway, I walk through and and they say, shalom, shalom, shalom. Everybody says, have a nice day.
Tada rabba.
And I'm like, that was a nice landing. He's like, we have our days. I'm like, okay.
So yeah, all these people are like landing these incredibly expensive fighter jets.
That's what I'm saying.
So it's like, yeah.
It's not America.
Just smooch it. Yeah, just a little smooch. Right. A little, just kiss it. Little tap.
By the way, when I land in America, when like I go through passport control and stuff and they go, all right, like have a nice day. I'm like, you're supposed to say welcome to America. They're like, welcome to America. I'm like, thanks.
Oh, you do not say
I do
that
tell them
event.
Sometimes.
That's so rude.
I want them to say welcome to America, okay? Like I want to hear this. I want to smell the cheese and I want to hear that. What's his name? The
Sinatra?
No, the other guy that your mom.
Oh,
liked.
Neil Diamond?
Yeah. We're coming to America.
Today.
Right. In Israel, when you land, I go through the fast lane because I have the one of these like fast lanes. So I don't get to actually see a human being that will greet me in Israel.
I get the human being.
In Israel, though,
but they're nice.
When the plane lands,
they're only the part of them that's not nice is the part of you that's just like the part of them that's just like a teensy weensy bit jealous because you've been somewhere in the world, and they're just sitting there, you know, coming to their job from wherever it is they live every day, and they wish that they were traveling.
Yeah, everybody wishes they were traveling.
Israelis love to travel.
Yeah, they do. They do love to travel. Anyway, so Vegas, and I think also a new Washington D.C. line. Which myself and my friends will certainly avail ourselves of. I could tell you that when I fly El Al, not to New York.
What airport is it going to fly into? There's a new DC line for El Al?
They're talking about, yeah. Hmm. I don't know. So, you know, like when I fly, let's say, to Florida or something like that, I fly to Boston because it's not as full of a flight. There's better seats. Anyway, it's a whole science. It turns out that flying is a science. You know, flying well is a science, and it's important to have a good flight because one thing about flights I've learned is that they can really mess you up. They can just, if you don't get your rest, if you're sitting very uncomfortably, you can really get kind of
up.
What's really fun on flights these days is that I see a lot of folks. I'll give you another example. I know a lot of folks that get like dressed into schlumpy clothes, pajamas,
comfy
basically
clothes.
Comfy clothes for flying. I don't, and I learned this from the great Rabbi Dan Rosenstein of the director of the Hebron Fund. Flights is a time where you can very likely meet important people. Mm. So, no, you want to be dressed. You're already on the trip when you're in the
business
airplane.
Casual.
Right. You already got to represent because you're going to meet
you
people.
You get those pants with a slightly stretchy fabric.
Yeah, well, that's
a little bit of give.
That's basically all my pants. Anyway, whatever. right. Okay, so we're back here on the Yishai Fleischer Show. And Malka, speaking of El Al, we're in election season.
Yes, it turns out that we are.
The elections have been now officially announced.
Right, everything's officially announced. I am not yet in the zone, personally. I'm not
gonna
like
There's
going to
be six new parties at least. Do you know that?
I don't want
There's like five
that.
Or six new parties.
Well, they're testing the waters right now. We'll see if there's actually five or six
new
parties.
But there are parties.
There's supposed to be a Gantz party. They were like, I saw in the news, they're like, Likud would clearly beat Gantz. I'm like, what is that? Is that a person?
Benny Gantz.
Benny Gantz, a former IDF chief of staff.
And they're thinking about making a Benny Gantz Boogie Yalon party.
I really hope
they
don't do
that. Which is a chief of staff party.
Oh, come on.
Or chiefs of staff? Or chiefs of staffers? I don't know. But I don't
feel like any new parties.
Well, the Yom HaBocher, the game of democracy is afoot.
Yes.
Here in Israel. And our PM, I had this realization. I was listening to one interview talking about who's going to win the next elections. Will Netanyahu be able to hold on to the
power?
Then the next discussion was about Netanyahu's legal woes.
Right.
And then this bombing that happened to Hezbollah, where some Hezbollahians were... Who love to eat Hezbollah, were Hezbollah'd up, out there in southern, where was it, in Lebanon or
in
was it in
Syria,
southern
in Syria.
In Syria? So then I'm like, this man, the PM, is fighting three wars. One, the political war, two, his legal war, and four, doing it all with a smile. I'm like,
he looks a little worn out, to be totally fair, after having been the minister of every single thing in this country for a couple months.
There's endless jokes. For example, just today I made the joke. We had a big Chevron event at the Knesset, massive, and every minister was there. But I said, except for like every minister was there, except for the foreign minister.
The defense minister, and
the prime minister, and what other ministries? He's got two other ministries.
Immigration. I think he gave away the immigration ministry.
So the bottom line is that it's just like one man is holding on to these ministries. Yeah. Anyway,
I have to say that I think that I a little bit wish that these elections had been called when Prime Minister Netanyahu wasn't on like kind of a fizzle out feeling. It feels like this term of Prime Minister Netanyahu a little bit like fizzled out as opposed to ending really strongly. I think he ended his term with a lot of criticism. Now, one of the interesting things about the Jewish people, though, is that on the one hand, we have an incredibly long memory. We have like a 3,500-year-old memory, which nobody else on this planet has. On the flip side, we have like an insanely short memory.
Yeah.
Where it's like over the course of 4 months, you could completely forget everything that happened in the past 4 years and like come totally fresh to these elections. So even though I think that Prime Minister Netanyahu did a mostly positive job as prime minister, I would give him, if I had to choose between thumbs up and thumbs down, I would definitely do thumbs up. But at the same time, it's like when election season comes around, it's really... anything could happen. And it's very interesting that there was a, like, everything is politicized now, every single thing. Like last night, there was a bombing at an airport in Syria. A private airliner, a cargo airliner, which has a history of having provided missiles to Hezbollah in the past, was bombed. Pretty much by Israel. Like, Israel's not denying it, and it's pretty much
according to foreign sources.
According to Newsweek. And they were apparently sending, Iran was apparently sending Hezbollah the technology to turn their rockets into guided missiles.
Right.
But also there were these officials, like high-ranking Hezbollah officials at the airport at the same time, who may have gotten on that plane to take a trip to Tehran.
Tehran.
I really hope, and I don't say this about many kinds of people, okay? But I really hope that Israel nailed these people. I hope they were on the plane. I hope that it was is something that will help to stop this horrible terror organization.
Do you understand the guts that it takes to make that
but
kind of call?
Guts to make that call? Crazy guts. Crazy you know, guts and to be the person who flies the plane and to be all those, every no. part of the apparatus.
Oh, yeah.
Every part of that apparatus, you have to have a lot of guts.
Yeah, man. I'm just saying, like, our prime minister...
Right. Oh, so all I mean to say is that now that the elections are on, I'm like, everything is going through my political filter.
Right.
And with this, I'm like... I thought to myself, I wonder what the aftermath of this is going to be security-wise, because right after Israel shot at this plane and then they shot at a bunch of different Iranian-related terror targets in Syria, a rocket was fired from Syria at Israel. And the Iron Dome missile defense systems in Hadera were set off. And apparently shot down this missile. Nothing is official.
That's like,
but basically they think that this missile went down over central Israel.
Wow. Do you realize like the level of alertness that these missile silos have
the Iron Domes?
The Iron Domes. It's like do 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 do. It's like, you know, and then suddenly
out of nowhere, it's weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks, and suddenly missile on your major city.
Right, but within seconds, you got to answer that within seconds.
Right, and that's one of the incredible miracles of this. Like let's see it from a religious perspective for a second. It's like God gave us this incredible miracle of this system, which has enabled us to really be so much more protected from rockets. This is a technology which is new for the Jews, and I'm personally very, very grateful. But the point I really wanted to make is that now that this has happened, I thought to myself, boy, is this going to be like a flare up? Like, are we going to now, you know, I saw in the news that Tel Aviv is going to be doing a drill about like their sirens. Where did they get the idea to all of a sudden the day after this big strike to make a big drill? Like, and some news reports said that this was in directly related to this attack. Others said, no, this drill had been scheduled ahead of time. Who knows? Right. You and I don't know the answer to that. But the point is, like, does this mean an escalation if Israel really did hit these high-up Hezbollah officials? Is Hezbollah going to try to respond? Is there going to be, like, a war thing? And then I thought to myself, the last thing that Hezbollah wants to do right now is start a war with us. Why? Because the Jewish people, when we get attacked, we go into a different mode. And the kind of mode that we go into is the same kind of mode that elects the most right-wing government that we can possibly elect. And now that we're in political season, I feel if I were Hezbollah, I would probably want to quiet it down, let the Jewish people do a little bit of infighting, start talking about some issues that are much, much more internal issues, less existential threat issues. And maybe, just maybe, they'll elect a more left-leaning, social issues-related government. But if we have a flare-up with Hezbollah or any of our other neighbors, it'll really do a lot for a right-wing nationalist government.
Good point, Malka. Good point. Yes. And again, I just there's a lot of courage and there's a lot of defense that's out there. And basically, for every attack that makes it through in Israel, there's about 10,000 that are stopped.
Well, I wrote an article this year that said that there was something like that the number of terror attacks, regular old terror attacks, I'm not even talking about like bombings and things like that, that Israel stops are about at the rate, at the average of 3 a day.
Yep. Okay.
And somebody's dealing with that as we're like going to the grocery store and, you know, trying to figure out our kids did their homework. There's like 3 terror attacks a day that some Israeli force is dedicated to stopping.
The terrorists want to hurt Jewish people and Jewish children. This week's Torah portion is one I think I recommended to you, and I mentioned it in the last half with Rabbi Mike Foyer, that this Shabbat is also the birthing Shabbat, birth coach Shabbat, midwife Shabbat. And I wanted to get your comments.
It's the parsha where the Jewish little Jewish babies are being born in Mitzrayim.
They're being born, but not only that, the midwives do not
are
listen,
saving them, right?
Saving them, not listening to Pharaoh. I talked about how the simple meaning is that actually these midwives are probably not Jewish midwives, but the Egyptian midwives. Hmm. That's the simple meaning of the text. But our sages understand it to mean that they were Jewish. The reason, the simple meaning is that they were not Jewish is that Pharaoh's calling them in and telling them to do X, Y, and Z. Why is he even calling in the Jewish midwives to what?
Why would they betray
comply?
Their sisters?
Right, so that doesn't make sense. So on simple level, it means that there's these Egyptian midwives who actually are not complicit, not going to be complicit with the initial pharaonic bad plan against the Jews. But in any case, Jewish midwifery is celebrated this Shabbat around the world. Not yet. It hasn't actually happened yet, but I believe that it could be the Shabbat of Jewish birth.
I like it.
You've been involved in making Jewish birth more spiritual, more holistic, more natural. You've done a lot of that. Right now you're a little bit on hiatus because of kids and husband flying. But really, it's an awesome field to be really involved with this incredible and still mysterious and still scary and yet incredibly moving and spiritual moment, which is the moment of birth.
Definitely. Once upon a time, I got certified to be a doula, which is basically a birth coach. And this is a long story that doesn't exactly belong on the radio, but basically
or on the Yishai Fleischer show, right?
Basically, after having my first child and it being a really long and difficult labor, as far as I was concerned, my second birth, where I was much, much shorter and I had a little bit of time to myself and I was doing all these I guided myself through meditation, kind of. I did all these meditations and I found that they all were very Jewish themed. And to me, that when my son was born, thank God, healthy, it was very uplifting to me. I felt afterwards that I'd been very uplifted and empowered by my experience. And I had the opportunity to go learn to be a doula, and I took that opportunity. And since then, I've been to a lot of births, thank God, friends and other women who've invited me to their births. And I definitely think, I don't think that spiritual birth is by any means the monopoly of Jewish women. I think that any woman on this planet can have a beautiful spiritual birth if she wants to. But as a Jewish woman and living here in the land of Israel, I think that we have a very special opportunity to really access not just the power of ourselves, which is definitely an aspect of giving birth, our woman power, but also to connect to generations and generations and generations of mothers and mothers and mothers and mothers and mothers before us, and all the way back, Yishai, to stories like this, and even all the way back farther, all the way to the very beginning of time, and to the miracles that God has done for Jewish women and for Jewish babies, and to help us continue on as a people, because that's what He likes, and that's what He wants. That's His plan, and we're honored to be a part of His plan. And yeah, I love the idea, Yishai, that we were talking about, that maybe one day that this parsha, there is other parshas which are meaningful to the Jewish people for other reasons.
And Moses is born.
Right, and Moses is born. That's right. That's nice. Yeah, that's true. That's even more more reason to do it. That this would be a good week to do, every year, to do, little conferences, getaways, birth classes, raffles. I don't know, whatever it is that you can think of that has to do with Jewish pregnancy and birth.
And as I always like to say, when you walk around Israel, you really see two signs of hopefulness. And that is cranes and pregnant women, right? You see cranes, which means building and the next generation and new apartments and more population, more Jewish population, and pregnant women. And when you see a pregnant woman, what you really think to yourself is like, okay, there's hope, there's family, there's togetherness, there's the next generation that's being born, and there's a future to Israel, and that's an awesome feeling. And of course, close by to us here is a hospital that holds one of the record in Israel, right?
Which it's is, not. It doesn't hold a record in Israel. It's Shaarei Tzedek Hospital, which has something like, I can't remember now, something 20, like 20 to 25,000 births a year. It doesn't hold the, I mean, it does hold the Israeli record for the most births of any Israeli hospital. But more importantly than that, it holds the world record for the most births at any hospital in the world. There's no hospital in the world that has more births every year than Shaarei Tzedek Hospital in Jerusalem.
That's a whole lot of baby.
That's a whole lot of babies. The Jewish
Baruch
women.
Hashem.
You know, the Jewish people have not had the peace of mind to have children at this rate in thousands of years.
You know, and when people like rip the state of Israel, I'm like, the state of Israel is the mechanism by which there is defense and electricity and buildings and hospitals and those certified doctors and those certified doctors in those buildings and the hospitals with the electricity on the land of Israel defended by the Israeli army is the vehicle to have the babies in the hospital.
Right.
Defended by the army with electricity on the land of Israel. Right. You know, it's like the state is the vehicle.
It is there, and it wants to promote Jewish life.
That's awesome. That is absolutely awesome. All right, folks. Malka, it's late here in the land of Israel. Jewish babies are sleeping.
And these Jewish grown-ups need to go to sleep, too.
Amen. And I also, I want to wish everybody some good sleeping. And I want you to send me some going-to-sleep tips. Mm. Okay, I want to hear your going-to-sleep tips. We sometimes use valerian root in this house, meditations, guided meditations, warm milk. I want to hear your theories on good.
There's some members of our household who sleep better with socks.
Right. Some people
and there's some who do not want to wear socks.
Yeah. I want to hear your sleep habits. I meant to say your
habits. Well, start on my left side.
I'm talking about if you have any going to sleep tips. I'd like to hear that. I also, before I let you go, I do want to recommend that you check out some of the sponsors of the show. I'm very proud. I've signed a product promotion. I'm a proud sponsor of the Tchelet.
Nice.
The good folks at Tchelet. Malka, it's time for us to order our Tchelet.
That's right.
We got to
order some children's Tchelet.
Yalla, let's do this. We got to order some children's Tchelet from Tchelet.com. Tchelet.com. That's awesome. So we got to definitely do that. And it is the True Blue Jew Blue String that is so special for your tzitzit. Our friend Yitzi from Jewish Lego, Jay Brick, was about to go, and I promoted it on last week's email. He was about, on the Ishai Fleischer email, he was about to go to London to teach about the Beit HaMikdash Lego set and its proportions and all that when he was summarily stopped at the border for not having some kind of proper Lego visa or something. I don't know. He has some kind of visa problem, and he was detained in a jail cell.
So wrong.
Oh, my God. Like
so
he is obviously, like, some kind of holy, like, and he's a Chabadnik. So he fulfilled the Rebbe's, the first Rebbe he wanted to teach Torah, and he said in prison instead. So that's powerful. So we hope to hear from Yitz. Being able to
I think the Alter Rebbe's yard site is coming up this week, he probably did that as a little ode to that.
Right, absolutely. So that's
he probably handed them 50 euros and was like, put me in jail.
That's at jbrick.com. And finally, I want to also thank the good folks.
I want to see the thing. He should do his like whatever it was he was going to do in England. He should do that here.
Yeah.
I want to go see the Mikdash
Lego set.
It's
Jeremy Corbyn, that bastard. He did it.
Jeremy Corbyn.
That anti-Semite. Oh, my God. Anyway.
Detain him.
Yeah. Jewish Lego, go to jail. All right. So that was
I wonder
that.
What it's like. You should have him on next week's show to talk about British jail.
Yeah. I'd like to hear all about that. And I hope that you do write an article on that. And also, finally, I want to thank the good friends at Hebron Fund, hebronfund.org, which keeps the lights on for the forefathers and mothers and helps get you there, hebronfund.org, our weekly English tour. Join it. And finally, I want to thank, of course, thelandofisrael.com for being this wonderific broadcasting network. And I want to thank God Almighty for the opportunity to live and to broadcast to you wherever you are. I want to hear from you. I've heard from some great emails recently, which I've not replied to yet. I shall. So thank you very much. God bless you. Stay tuned. Stay strong. Write me an email, yishai@thelandofisrael.com. Be part of the program. Get on the program. You are part of the program, not just the Yishai Fleischer Show, but the much bigger program, which is God's great dream that's happening in this world, the ingathering of the Jewish people to the land of Israel, the rebirth of the land of Israel, the flourishing of Torah, a great light that's coming down for the whole world, a messianic, Davidic, Elijah heralding great time that we're living in. And I'm lucky that I'm living this life with Malka Fleischer. Malka, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks, Yishai.
God bless you, everybody. Shabbat shalom. Shabbat stay tuned, shalom. Stay strong, stay connected. We'll hear from you soon. Lots of love from Israel, and shalom.
To make war upon rebellion is messy and slow, says T.E. Lawrence, like eating soup with a knife. Now I admit, I find life messy, but I never seem to feel that it's slow. I'm Rav Mike Foyer, and this is The Jewish Story.
Join Rav Mike Foyer for the best Jewish history podcast, The Jewish Story, on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com.